This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared, where great minds meet. I'm Head of Programming, Connor Boyle. On the podcast for this episode, we welcome back Megan Nolan, the author and journalist whose debut novel, Acts of Desperation, told the tale of a self-destructive university dropout and topped critics' lists in 2021, returns with a new book this year, Ordinary Human Failings. Our host for this episode is Holly Williams, herself an author, journalist, and critic. She's formerly staff writer and arts editor for The Independent, and her work has appeared in titles ranging from The New York Times to The FT. Her latest novel is The Start of Something, coming soon in 2024. Let's join Holly Williams now in conversation with Megan Nolan.
Megan Nolan is an Irish award-winning author, cutting to the quick at the most uncomfortable facets of the human experience. Her latest book, Ordinary Human Failings, follows Tom, a young tabloid reporter, doing a grisly scoop after a young child is murdered on a London council estate. Local suspicion is pinned on the reclusive Green family and their youngest member, 10-year-old Lucy Green. But as Tom works to tease out salacious details of a family that appear rotten to the core, what is brought into relief is a far richer portrait of morally grey characters woven together by intergenerational trauma. Welcome to Intelligence Squared, Megan.
Thank you. So nice to be here with you.
So great to have you here. So let's start at the very beginning with the title of the book. So how does the concept of ordinary human failings sort of speak to the murder that is at the centre of this plot, which is obviously a very extraordinary crime?
So yeah, just to some actual background about the phrasing of that, my friend Fiona was in Trinity. I dropped out of college like fairly immediately after starting it, but Fiona was in college and she once told me about this note that her seminar leader had sent around saying, basically, as I paraphrase in the book, it's from the newspaper editor. And in this, it was from her seminar leader. And he had said, you know, reasonable excuses for missing a seminar include the death of a parent, serious illness. They do not include ordinary human failings such as hangovers and heartbreak, which I always just, it just like stuck in my head as a phrase after that. But in terms of like how it relates to the subject matter of the novel, I suppose it's because like when Tom, the journalist, is like trying to find like a singular reason for all the tragedy that is surrounding his family.
And then your debut, Acts of Desperation, was sort of quite an interior and self-reflexive book, looking at a woman and her relationships. How was it to then, in this one, to kind of expand that out to accommodate multiple characters and perspectives, even if they are in this real pressure cooker of a situation?
Yeah, I think like obviously in a way I sort of cheated it a bit because there's like so much close third in Ordinary Human Failings where like, you know, even though it's not first person perspective, I still am like going into the psychological perspective of these people in quite an invasive and intimate way as I did with Acts of Desperation. But I think it was, well, I found it really, really useful and really fun in a way, even though obviously it's like a dark book, but I found it quite fun to like be able to zip around between them because like Acts of Desperation on purpose was meant to be kind of grueling, you know, and like you're stuck inside this person's perspective because she's stuck inside her own perspective and it's meant to like replicate the feeling of being her, which is like exhilarating, but also very exhausting and like, yeah, and very claustrophobic. And then, yeah, so like it was, that's what I wanted to be doing with that book, but it also was like quite draining to write at times. And especially because it was like sort of a version of myself in my much earlier 20s. And so, you know, when I was writing it, trying to be sympathetic to the character, but also like getting really fed up with writing this person at times. And it felt good with Ordinary Human Failings to be able to like leave one, because, you know, none of them are more than roughly like 15,000 words of their close perspective. So I never felt like exhausted by any of them. And I felt like I wanted to know more about them, if anything, which felt better, you know. And also just like, I don't know, it was kind of enjoyable to, like, in Act of Desperation, I sort of was exercising a lot of feelings that I had actually had, but I just, you know, maybe never acted on, or like concerns I had that I had spent my career working on a little bit, like about men and relationships and dependence and all these things. And so, like, I was sort of doing Act of Desperation as a way to never have to write about those things again, in a way, or like to never have to like only write about them again. And then with Ordinary Human Failings, it felt like I had this nice chance to project into each of these different characters, like very, very wide ranging, but persistent interests of mine that are like not what I do or like what I experience myself, but things that I've thought about for a long time. And I was able to sort of, yeah, like because of the family being like made up of these very isolated units who are not speaking to one another, kind of able to like disseminate a lot of very wide ranging interests of mine into the family. And that felt really good.
And you mentioned there that Acts of Desperation had some sort of overlap with your personal essays that you write as a journalist. Did you ever feel like you were sort of funneled towards or expected to write those kind of personally revealing pieces, that sort of the currency for young female writers?
I think like in very basic logistic terms, if you don't have any money, if you're not making any money as a journalist, which obviously nobody is in general, but especially when you're starting out and you're trying to, and like, this hasn't really got better since maybe it's even gotten worse since I was trying to become a journalist, but like you're writing things for 60, 70 quid and like trying to make yourself publishable. And if you don't have the resources to go reporting, like your own life is kind of all you have to work from, in a way. Like you can definitely like, and I did also do some arts writing, like reviewing books, films, but like nobody knows who you are, so they don't actually care what you think about a book or a film. But if you have an experience that you're willing to be quite stark about or quite revealing about, and you're good at writing, then like you kind of probably will get published. So I think that like it's not so much that people demanded it of me, but it's that they weren't demanding anything of me, and that is the one thing that they would publish, you know. And like now I have a wider range of stuff that I'm able to get commissioned for, but still it's sort of like the thing that people still want the most from me is to write that kind of essay. And it's just like, it's not something that I want to do all the time anymore. Occasionally I'll still do it, but it is diminishing returns. I think like, I think you can always write about your own life and like, and about anyone's life. And I'm a big believer in the idea that like, literally anyone on earth, I think, is interesting to have a book written about them, which is not the same as the saying about like everyone has a book in them. I don't think like everyone is able to write a good book, but I think everyone on earth is interesting enough to warrant attention and care and like this sort of attention that you would have to spend to write about someone in a book. I really believe that, and that includes myself, you know. But I do feel better that now that I have a different sort of career, that I'm able to like write longish essays about things that are not myself, because I don't want to do that all the time. And also, if you have any sort of public facing career, it becomes like a bit nastier, you know. Like I don't want to write intimate things about my relationship while I'm posting to Instagram at the, you know, like it's just a bit weirder publicizing a book and like trying to be a public facing figure. It's not the same feeling as like when I was 24 and I didn't have any career, and then I could like kind of write whatever I wanted about anyone, because it wasn't like threatening. It wasn't like I was publishing in the New York Times. I was publishing on a blog or whatever. And so, yeah, I think obviously things have changed, but I still really enjoy writing that way though. And like, I'll probably do some iteration of it in a book at some point, like a collection of essays, I reckon, probably.
And then obviously Ordinary Human Failings sort of takes the kind of idea of a tantalizing mystery of what's the reason behind this appalling crime, and then sort of turns that on its head by going there's loads of reasons and there's no one big specific reason. You know, it's a complicated morass. Does that feel to you kind of opposed or at odds with the prevailing perhaps fashion for kind of true crime things that do seed little things and then give you a big reveal?
Yeah, I do think that because, yeah, I think I guess part of I sort of worked backwards a little bit with this book in terms of. So like I knew that there was going to be a crime, and then I knew that I wanted a child to be suspected of the crime. And then I started to think and do quite a lot of research about the kinds of children who do tend to be capable or likely to commit serious violence. And you know, there's all sorts of different, obviously there's like a wide range of reasons why a child would be, but a common one as is like, I think fairly common knowledge is like parental abuse or neglect. So obviously in my book, Lucy's not like actively abused. Nobody in her home is hitting her or verbally abusing her, but she is severely neglected emotionally and in material ways. And so that was sort of the starting point. And then I kind of worked backwards in a way to think about her mother, to think about like, why would a mother be capable of so deeply emotionally abandoning her baby? And that then led me to the idea of the unwanted pregnancy in Ireland, and obviously that abortion being illegal in Ireland until 2018. And so, yeah, I kind of had this like spiraling network of things that I wanted to happen in the story, and then thinking about why they might have happened. And yeah, I think the lack of a big, you know, there's a part in the book where Tom, the journalist, is trying to sort of imply that, there may be like incest at play, and there might be that there's some huge, like singular pinpoint reason why this family is so dysfunctional, and yeah, I just think that's not usually the case, or even when it is the case, if there's something very very like dramatic of that nature, then there's still a world of like very fine, like thinly. Like small context surrounding it, you know, shrouding it, that will always like be more interesting than the single bullet point version of that. And yeah, I think I just enjoyed, and I do enjoy to try and like, yeah, to try and work backwards a little bit and to think about how things like follow on. And also, you know, the habits that, and not even like, not even the really bad things, but like, the fairly minor habits that John bequeaths to his kids, like there's a part in the book where he has a habit of clearing his plate very quickly when he finishes a meal. So like he'll finish his dinner and have to get rid of it after like as soon as he's finished eating, he has to clear it off and clean the plate. And this is sort of like a habit that his children have inherited, and that's like from my family. Like my dad always did that. And eventually at some point my stepmother very casually like mentioned that she was like, oh, that's probably because of the Good Shepherd, which is the name of the like the Catholic institution that my grandmother grew up in, because her parents weren't around, so she grew up in this like horrifying institution, and just like things like that, that when I realized that, and that was something I had been doing my entire life, I had like been finishing eating and have to clean my plate within 20 seconds. And then I kind of learned this fact about myself that I'd never known after 20 years, you know, that there was this reason. And I just find that really interesting. I think there's like so many in anyone's life, I think there's so many little moments of that nature that like, if you're aware enough and you want to ask enough of the people around you, you'll probably find some really, really illuminating like causes for things that go on in your life to this day, you know?
And then in terms of that passing down of things through the generations, how do you think we can sort of identify responsibility or deal with responsibility for violent crime, especially in the case of minors, in that context of generational trauma, where something learned might not be as innocent as clearing your plate, but you know, yeah, could lead to these sort of really serious consequences?
I won't really speak to that in terms of adults, because I don't, as in, like, I think it's just so impossible to say what is fair in that realm. As in, like, obviously it goes without saying that a lot of people who commit crimes, like who commit violent crimes, have trauma in their past. And I genuinely, I'm not saying this to like evade answering. I just genuinely don't know what is the fair way to treat people who you can clearly see the lineage of like them being taught it. And it's so impossible to me to like identify where the line is, like where you have to go, oh no, now you're responsible. But before this, others are responsible for your, you know, like, it's really hard for me to say that. But in terms of minors, I do think there's like, so like that, when you're talking about adults, it's a little bit more of an abstract, or like you have to like you have to like create lines for yourself as adult in terms of adult responsibility. But I do think with minors, it's actually quite clear to me, and that's because not every country in the world is like England or America, and other countries do it better, and it's very, very clear how to do it better. And so I do think with minors, it's a much easier question, which is like, so there was a great example of this where it was roughly comparable time frame to James Bulger's murder, which I think was 92 in the UK. And obviously that was 2 10-year-old boys. And then I think it was 1995 in Norway, there was a 5-year-old girl who was killed by two young boys. I can't remember their exact ages, but I think they were maybe 8 and 10-ish, that sort of age again. And just like the ways that those two different cases were treated by these different societies was so extreme and so just mind-blowing to see the compassion that people in that society had for the parents of the perpetrating kids. Like they didn't have this insane witch hunt that they did with the families of the killers of James Bulger. Like they understood that something had gone catastrophically wrong, and they wanted to try and address that, and they did. And like the boys obviously didn't get to go home and never think about it again. They had to like deal very much with the consequences of their action, but they didn't treat these tiny children as though they had adult consciousnesses and like were able to plan and decide. And like also like children, as I it's sort of a little bit in my books go into, like children don't know what death means sometimes. They don't know what, like, they don't have permanence in their minds yet, you know, like they don't understand that killing means forever or that death means forever. And that's not an excuse or like something that you should be saying to exonerate somebody, but it is a reality that like children don't have the same minds as adults, and we do have to take that into account. And yeah, I just think like 10 being the age of responsibility in England is absolutely wild. And like, I just don't understand why in a supposedly civilized country that would still be the case. Like, because people have learned from like the failings of how the James Bulger case was, you know, like in terms of naming these kids, like that was a terrible mistake. And I think everyone would probably admit that now, given how it went, you know, like I don't think people are in a rush to be naming child perpetrators, generally speaking, anymore. But like, I just don't see how in light of like how that situation took place, why you would ever be treating a 10-year-old like an adult. And yeah, it makes me really upset to think about it. And like, and just like the powerlessness of like a kid who's done something wrong. I don't know. It's just really difficult to contemplate treating them as though they had all the sense that an adult has, you know.
Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic, 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared, so many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared.
This book sort of is a fictional telling of a crime, but as I said, we have had real kind of interest and obsession even with true crime stories, and particularly in recent sort of years. Are you a fan of true crime? Were you hoping to sort of do something very different to that in terms of telling stories that are compelling but avoid being exploitative or sort of voyeuristic?
Yeah, I think it wasn't consciously an aim of mine, but I definitely do think, because, yeah, I do read, do I read a lot of true crime? Definitely when I was younger, I did. I still really love like some kinds of nonfiction. I love Gordon Byrne, and like obviously his books are, I suppose you could call them true crime, but it almost feels like a disservice to them. But basically the answer is yes, I do like consume a lot of true crime. And I do think that part of what I was hoping to do with this book was like, because I'd noticed more in my like earlier life, in my late teens, early 20s, when I was like mental and was like not, and was not like consuming any kind of media in a healthy way, because I was just trying to distract myself from my like deep unhappiness at the time. So I would just like compulsively read things and like read horrible true crime things and just be on like the Wikipedias of the most fucking sordid serial killers imaginable, and like reading the event, like, and it's just this slurry, this like grotesque like outpouring of like the most awful actions imaginable, and I would just be like reading, it was like just like a list of actions almost. And I think like writing this book, I wanted to like, yeah, like do the opposite, and not like, it's not obviously that this book is like it barely has any of the horrifying action. Like, you don't really get a scene where where Mia, the baby, is being killed. Like, you don't really get to see the terrible event. And you get to see everything else instead, like all of the sort of minutia that surrounded the terrible event and that contributed to the terrible event and followed it and so on. And yeah, I think there is something like it's difficult because I do think it can be overstated. Like, when people are sort of like tutting about true crime and being like, why do people want to read about these things? It's like, well, very obvious why people want to read about these things, because they're very, very interesting, because they're the most unusual and grotesque things that happen. So like, why wouldn't we be interested in them in a certain sense? And like, I do believe that. And I don't think we should be like pretending to be shocked that people find crime interesting. Like, that's, you know, like going outside of society is obviously the, you know, there's a reason why society exists, to be normative. And so to like escape that, of course, is interesting and is engaging. And also it's like exhilarating to go, oh, people don't have to do these things that I do every day and that like I've been told and taught to do. People can really go outside of that in ways that are disgusting or and like not appealing to replicate, but are like so beyond our understanding of like how to live that it's like, it's of course that's interesting. But I do think if you're just like reading, as I say, like basically a list of facts, like reading a list of events, I do think that is degrading to the human brain and soul. I wasn't a better person for having read those details and nothing else. You know, it was not a good thing for me. And I think that like we should be judicious about the way we consume these things, even while I do think it's fine for us to find them interesting. Yeah.
And then you write from the perspective of several of the family members and also from the journalist, Tom, but not from the perspective of the child. Did you attempt to write as Lucy at all, or what was your thought process behind that?
No, I didn't really. I think actually really early on, I was talking to my agent about the book or like about the idea for the book. And she she was like, be very careful about writing anything from the child's perspective. And I kind of just knew that I didn't want to do that. I think I'd read bad versions of that in a lot of novels or even actually like in films. And like, I just think it's very, very hard to pull off capturing the mind of a child of that age. Because yeah, again, because there's like so much mystery about like how much a child of that age understands or doesn't understand and how they engage with the world, that I just didn't feel capable of doing that. But also I did then also justify that to myself by saying part of the mystery of the book is how much Lucy understands. And so I didn't want to say, you know, from Lucy's perspective, and then I went over there and killed Mia, or I went over there and I didn't kill Mia. You know, like I didn't want to have that perspective because I didn't want it to be a kind of open and shut case, you know, or I didn't want it to be, I guess like as you said earlier, like there is like a mystery in the book in a way, but I didn't want all of the action of the book to be based around whether or not she did it, you know, like there needed to be other things at play and like other stakes in that situation. And so, yeah, I just didn't want to have this like clear-eyed child describing exactly what happened, because that would have kind of spoiled a lot of the reason for the rest of the book happening. Yeah.
And you recently moved to New York. How do you think such a tale might have played out in the, you know, quite different social and cultural context of the US?
Yeah, it's a good question. I never thought about that. I guess like there obviously have been famous child murders here, but I do think, I don't know exactly why this is, but I do think the cultural atmosphere of like class issues in England was definitely partially like why the James Bulger murder was so seminal as a sort of cultural moment in England at that time. Like this sort of idea of a feral underclass and like the violent videos and, you know, the kids being left to their own devices and then watching these things and replicating them. And like, I don't know. I don't know what the exact equivalent of that would be here. I don't know if like the class, obviously there are class divisions here, which are incredibly grotesque and like very visible in New York, especially. But I don't know if there's exactly the same sort of like terror of like the like the bad version of the working class that there really is in British media and in British culture. Like, I do think there's like, there's something where like, I don't know how to say this exactly, but I think there's something where people in England who are not doing well financially, materially, socially, are encouraged to like deeply hate the person who's almost exactly like them, but you know, they're being convinced that they're worse by by the government, by the media, like that there's someone down the road who's like cheating on their benefits or who uses their dole to get a huge telly and that's evil or whatever. I do think there's something like icky in English society, which is stoked a lot, where people are encouraged to judge other people who are essentially the same as themselves and to like put their hatred toward them instead of the people causing these conditions. I don't think I know the US enough to comment on what that situation would be like here. And I think like there was an amazing story though. I think this was maybe like the 80s or early 90s. Basically, a journalist totally fabricated this like, I mean, it's quite funny when you read it knowing it's fake because it's a little bit like Flann O'Brien, like parodying Irish maudlin literature. So like, basically this woman wrote, I think it was the Washington Post, but I could be wrong. This woman wrote an article during like the kind of the crack epidemic becoming, well, I think that was like kind of obviously rumbling on since the 70s really, but it was kind of coming to a media peak in the early 90s. And this woman wrote this kind of shock horror story about a 10-year-old kid. That's the reason I'm thinking of it, is because also a 10-year-old, like a 10-year-old being just like doing the most evil, horrendous things imaginable. And then it turned out that she had gone to this like housing estate trying to find that story, had failed to find it, and had just like invented this child. And I just always thought that was such a perfect encapsulation of like, you know, like these journalists who just like want to find, they literally are like hunting for the stereotype they've imagined in their head. And then they come across actual people and they're like, oh no, that will never do. And they have to like translate it into some actual cartoon character they've made up, you know?
Mm. Yeah, the character of Tom obviously is really alive to how much he can demonize the characters of this estate for being poor as much as anything else. That is something that sells. Do you think we've moved on from that since the sort of era you're writing about in the novel? Or do you think it's just that kind of, that media circus or that way of representing the working classes has tilted a little bit in our public consciousness or our public discussions?
Yeah, I do think that like the likes of Benefit Street and like that moment in popular representation does feel different. I could be wrong, but it doesn't feel to me like people would swallow that as easily as they did back then. And also, you know, like the boogeyman shifts, right? Like in all these spheres. So there was for sure that moment in British tabloid press where to be like, I don't know, I like kind of pre when Chav was a thing, but like that moment of like being terrified of this particular kind of working class person, it doesn't really feel like that is the primary boogeyman right now. And I do think that like different racial lines have been drawn and especially about immigration, like I think that sort of like superseded the like total demonization of like, you know, of English working class people. I think that like in the years following that sort of craze, you can see that the Sun and the Daily Mail like definitely have amped up their like their coverage of who they see to be like illegitimate immigrants and refugees. And I think that seems to me the more prominent, like, the more prominent like folk devil of the moment than that. Yeah.
And you've moved from Ireland to London and now from London to New York. What inspiration do you get when you sort of move to a new country, and what do you think you might draw from this new home that you're in now?
So I think like, it's a little bit like someone once said to me, my friend Duren, who's like my best friend from home, once said to me, like, every breakup makes you a better person. And like, I sort of feel like that about moving as well. Just like, it's really, really hard. Like, I'm not like very happy right now, but I can feel that like interesting things are happening and like, you know, formative things are happening. But it's very uncomfortable, like leaving the place that, like, I lived in London for 9 years and my life was there and my friends are there and I have friends here as well, but like I have no grounding here. I have no like history. I don't have a bank account, you know, like you have to start all over again. And that's really exhausting. And especially cause like I'm not in my early 20s anymore as I was when I moved to London. And so like, it is actually physically exhausting to like start all over again. But I just think I can afford to also like the choices I've made. Like, I don't want to have children. I'm not married. These are like intentional choices. And they were because of wanting to be free to like try things. And so I'm trying to just do that because I don't want to like, I don't know. I don't want to have sacrificed certain kinds of stability and then not do anything with that freedom, you know? I feel like I want to be back in Ireland at some point longer term, but now is the time that I can afford to like try things out a little bit. And then in terms of like what New York will give me, I mean, it's just like the, obviously like it's the best place in the world really. And like, it's just inexhaustible. Like there's like no minutes of the day here where I don't feel excited and good that I'm here, you know, like, and that was also true when I moved to London in a way, but like, I don't know. People are a little bit more upbeat here, basically. And people in London are a little, seemed by the end of my time there to be really increasingly dissatisfied with London. And people here love here, you know, like people in New York are obsessed with New York and that just makes you feel good about trying to be here. And I'm setting some of my next novel here. And so that was sort of my justification for coming, is that I could, you know, spend some time in the neighborhoods that part of it is set in and that kind of thing.
And are you able to tell us anything about what that novel might be about or what sort of story you want to tell?
Yeah, so there's kind of two strands to it. I wanted to write about two... I'm just realizing as I'm about to say this is literally the plot of When Harry Met Sally, but no, it's not really. But I wanted to write about a woman and a man who are extremely intimate, close friends, but are not romantically involved, and like how that plays out when they are both married or when they're both with somebody else. Just because like a lot of my very close friends are men, and actually a lot of them are men that I dated once, and that's not like super usual, and something that, you know, like a new partner has to kind of come to terms with. And then I had this one particular friendship with my best friend here, Daniel, who like we met through like Tinder, I can't remember if it was Tinder or Hinge or whatever, but like online dating, and like went on a date and it was fine, but we both were just like, you know what, I think you're the best person I've ever met, but I don't think I want to kiss you. And we just became extremely like overly close friends, you know, like we spend a lot of our time together, and it's something that, not that it's hard for my now partner to deal with, but it's like definitely something that's unusual. And I started to kind of think about the different ways that could play out in like people who are a bit older than me. So like I'm 33 and I was thinking a little bit in the future, like what would it be like if I'm married for me and Daniel to try and maintain this insane degree of closeness that we have. So that's one strand of it. And then also I want to write about the idea of the child of a great or like renowned artist keeping their estate or like maintaining their estate after the artist dies. So like I went to see this show in MoMA in October last year, which was about this like radical filmmaker and an actor called Pierre Clémenti, and his son was there sort of like showing some films of his, and one of them was his home movie. And you know, like in the home movie, his son, whose name is Balthazar, is like 3 years old and its parents are these like glorious, beautiful stars. And it's really quite moving, even for like me as a stranger to watch. And then I looked at him at Balthazar and he's like, he's now in his 70s and he's like openly weeping watching his family in this film. And I just thought, oh my God, it's such an interesting idea to like have spent your life maintaining your father's art and like showing it to people in this way. And like, I don't know, to... And I haven't like come down on a side of like it's good or bad, but like you have to give up a lot of your own ego to like dedicate yourself to someone else's work like that. So yeah, I think basically one of the two friends that I described she's the daughter of like this kind of great artist. And yeah, those are the two things that I want to get into with it.
I can't wait to read it. Megan, thank you so much for chatting to us. That was Megan Nolan, author of Ordinary Human Failings, now available in paperback from Penguin and bookstores near you. I've been Holly Williams, and you've been listening to Intelligence Squared. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced by Mia Sorrenti and edited by Tom Hall. If you want to keep up with everything going on at Intelligence Squared, sign up to the newsletter. Head over to intelligencesquared.com to get the heads up on all our live events coming up. And members can also peruse over 20 years of our back catalogue featuring some of the world's great minds. That's all over at intelligencesquared.com.